Can you hear me? Yep.
Yes.
Okay, hello everyone. Well, I hope you've been enjoying the next comp so far. We've definitely been enjoying what we've heard. First of all, welcome to Tux's Angels Incident Response Unraveled. Something to lighten the mood to get us going. Yeah, I thought there'd be a few laughs. I didn't actually find it all that funny, but. First of all, who are we? Well, my name is Amelia Chowton, and as was introduced, this is Kate McInnes and Vanessa Tomar. And we are all IT security geeks. We work for the Department of Defence in the Information Security Group in a team called the Computer Network Vulnerability Team. So the CMET, the Computer Network Vulnerability Team, has many roles which we perform for state and federal Australian government agencies. One of our main roles is performing 24/7 incident response. We also provide IT security advice and assistance. We perform vulnerability assessments, as well as penetration testing and red teaming, and conduct research and development and provide education and training. So this is the agenda for our presentation today. Today we're aiming to teach you how we use Linux and open source tools to investigate incidents and demonstrate how these tools can be used in everyday situations. So first of all, we're going to start about talking about incident response and introducing the incident response lifecycle. And then we're going to be talking about how we use Linux and free and open source software to perform incident response. And then we're going to be talking about and demoing numerous tools in the context of an investigation. And finally, providing a conclusion, wrapping up the investigation and detailing any results. So first of all, incident response, for those that don't know. Sorry, this thing's a bit funny. There we go. An incident simply is an event or situation of non-compliance with corporate security policies or procedures that risk the confidentiality, availability or integrity of data, whether the situation is real or perceived. For example, a Trojan, malware, loss of data, unauthorised access or maybe even suspicious network traffic. And incident response simply is dealing with that incident or handling the incident to ensure that minimal or no data is lost and systems are restored to normal and any malicious activity is ceased. So there are numerous things that should be kept in mind when performing incident response and many procedures that need to be followed, way too many to talk about in this presentation, but there are a few key IR, incident response procedures, that we wanted to mention today. For example, it's important to inform management of any incidents to ensure their continued support. But maybe more importantly, it's vital to get law enforcement involvement early if criminal activity is suspected. It's essential this is done early on in the process. Also, another important factor to keep in mind when dealing with data in all phases of the incident response lifecycle is the importance of forensic integrity. This may include working from copies, not the original, ensuring the media is mounted read-only and that inode access times aren't updated. And this is vital if the investigation goes to court. So having an incident response lifecycle is essential to ensure that processes are followed in a logical manner that makes sense. So there are numerous different types of incident response lifecycles that exist out there, but we're going to be just talking about a fairly simple one that involves three phases, which is detection, collection and analysis. There are other lifecycles out there that also include other phases, such as a reporting or a mitigation area as well, but this is a fairly simple one. The detection phase, which is the first one, involves identifying if an incident has occurred, and ensuring that it isn't a false positive. The second phase of the life cycle is collection, and that's acquiring the data relevant to an incident. And the last phase, analysis, involves a detailed examination of all collected data to piece together what happened, enabling the results to then be fed back into detection for mitigation purposes. Okay, so moving on to our next agenda item, which is Linux and free and open source software. So why do we use Linux in incident response? Well, because it lets us do what we want and only does what we tell it to do. It's non-invasive, so by turning off the auto mount, we don't need to worry about attached media being modified, and this almost eliminates the need for write blockers. But for extra verification, hashes can also easily be done of the copy and of the original to ensure they're identical. Also, another reason we use Linux in incident response is the support for multiple file systems. So we only need to use the one OS to analyze different platforms. And also, Linux offers more operating system control, enabling us to specify how different devices are treated. So we can also easily write custom scripts to perform whatever we want. And finally, one of the most useful features of using Linux in open source is the loopback device feature, which enables regular files to be treated as block devices, and more importantly, allows devices to be mounted however desired, whether this be read-only, no A time, for example. So why do we use free and open source software as part of incident response? Well, the open source community often provides the most cutting-edge technology, which isn't available in the vendor space yet. And also, the tools can be customized to suit our needs, and often there are less surprises, so we can view the source and know exactly what's going on. And of course, both are free, which is a big advantage. So how do we select tools for incident response? Well, there are a few important factors that we consider. For example, how easy it is to install is pretty important, especially if it's a single-use tool that needs to be installed in a hurry. How easy is the tool to understand and configure, because we want to work out how to perform the main functions of the tool in minimal time. Also, how accurate and updated is the tool, the support and documentation available, and finally, the reputation of the developers as well is pretty important when selecting a tool for incident response. Okay, so now we're going to move on to our next item, which is introducing an investigation. So if I can work out how to detach this microphone. Here's Kate.
All right, so as Amelia said before, today we'll be working through an investigation into an incident. And the investigation will follow the three main phases of the incident response lifecycle, so detection, collection, and analysis. And we'll present the tools and techniques that we use at each phase of the cycle. So ultimately, the main aim of today is to demonstrate how we use Linux and open source software to enable us to easily and efficiently solve a case. So let's start by introducing the actual incident. So an incident was reported to Tux's Angels, and that's us, by the administrator of Playground Incorporated, who suspected that one of their workstations, Alpha, had been compromised. So the incident was actually reported to us at approximately 4:30 p.m. on the 19th of December last year. The administrator informed us that Alpha resides in the playground.net1.myturf.net domain, and Playground Incorporated also requested the on-site assistance of Tux's Angels. So before going on site, we were actually forwarded three details of the network on which the incident occurred. As you can see here, the Playground domain consists of Alpha, which was the workstation that was suspected of being compromised. It's running Windows XP SP2, fully patched, and its IP address is 10.1.1.2. We also have the domain controller, which is configured as a DNS server and running Active Directory, and its IP address is 10.1.1.1. And we also have a gateway, which is also known as Agent, and it's been configured as a simple NAT with no firewall functionality. Its internal IP address is 10.1.1.254, external IP address is 192.168.1.1. It's probably worth noting that anything beyond the external interface of the gateway is considered untrusted. So the administrator of Playground Incorporated also provided us with the following details regarding the circumstances surrounding the incident, which we have timelined here. So on this timeline, the top band represents hour and the bottom band represents day. So on the 19th of December at about 12 p.m, Alpha was connected to the internet. The administrator suspects the compromise of Alpha occurred somewhere between 12 p.m. and 4 p.m. The administrator's activities between 12:30 and 2:45 p.m. included patching Alpha, updating the AFIC hash database, which we'll talk about later, downloading and installing applications before rebooting the machine. 15 minutes later, the administrator noticed that the wallpaper on Alpha had changed. And 50 minutes later, a snort alert for a telnet connection was generated at the gateway. If you're interested, the open source software we use to generate these timelines is called Simile Timeline, and it's really cool, and it's a project that's run out of MIT. So now we know the details surrounding the incident, let's now move on to the actual investigation. And the investigation begins with the first phase of the IR lifecycle, detection. So I'll now hand back to Amelia.
Thank you, Kate. Okay, the first phase of the incident response lifecycle, detection. Detection is about determining if a security incident has occurred. It includes detection and initial pre-investigation response, as well as validating, assessing, and determining a response strategy. So data to detect an incident may come from a variety of sources. It may come from an IDS or logs or users, even odd system behaviour, or maybe even a feeling that something's not quite right. But in the end, detection is about pulling together all the tools and resources available to work out if a security incident has occurred. There are a variety of tools that are available to detect a security incident. And these can, just in general, be broken down to network-based intrusion detection systems, or NIDS, host-based intrusion detection system, or HIDS, and logwatch and alerting tools. So first of all, NIDS attempts to find attacks targeting the network to gain access, typically by inspecting raw packets as they travel across the network. So when Tux's Angels, which is us, arrived on site at Playground Inc., we discovered that Playground Inc. had a NIDS in place. They were using Snort, but they'd also considered a few other options as well. So when designing the system security, they'd considered using Segwell, EasyIDS, as well as Snort with a base interface. Segwell was considered initially because it has a Snort backend and allows the deployment of multiple sensors and multiple instances of Snort to be running, pulling back all the alerts into one central analysis station. However, as Playground Inc. only had one sensor running, it decided that Segwell was overkill. EasyIDS was also considered. This is one installation package that includes Snort, Base, OinkMaster, and NTOP, and it's designed for the network security beginner with minimal Linux experience. However, the sysadmins decided they really just wanted Snort with a custom install because they wanted to be able to change how Snort operates if needed. And so therefore, Playground Inc. decided to have Snort with a base interface. Another detection mechanism I talked about was HIDS, and this monitors the dynamic behaviour and state of a computer system. So when Tux's Angels arrived on site, we discovered that they had a HIDS in place, and specifically they were using a file integrity checker. And this file integrity checker had been incorporated into their workstation SOE. So again, Tux's Angels were told that numerous options were considered for the HIDS. Initially, AID was considered, which is one of many free replacements for Tripwire, but although AID looked impressive, they didn't think it ran on Windows, which was the environment that the sysadmins were going to be monitoring. Labrador was also considered as a file integrity checker. It runs on Windows and offers similar features to AID, but two real advantages of a Labrador were the fact that it can enforce policy and integrity compliance by warning whenever a new file is created or deleted in a given directory, and also allows admins to restore the system back to the original state if it's been set accordingly. In the end, AFIC was chosen by the sysadmins at Playground Inc. AFIC, another file integrity checker, has previously been used and is similar to Tripwire. It's portable, operates on Windows, it's pretty fast, easy to install, and it displays news, deleted and modified files, as well as dangling links, and it has a command line and GUI interface for the analysts or sysadmins to look at. So as well as having a NIDS and HIDS, the sysadmins at Playground Inc. realised that they needed a logwatch and alerting tool, because they realised, like most people, that they were notoriously bad at reviewing logs. So they had Swatch installed to look at these security logs. They told us they'd also considered numerous options when designing the security of their system. So they'd considered LogCheck, which simplifies reviewing logs by mailing out summaries of log files to sysadmins after removing the sort of normal entries. And DVLog as well, as it detects unknown attacks by finding anomalies in syslog. This can be used in many environments, but mainly operates on a centralized logging server, which Playground Inc. didn't actually have installed, but it still looks to be quite interesting, so in the future maybe that could be an interesting option. But in the end, Swatch was chosen by Playground Inc. because it doesn't just scan logs periodically, like most log analysis tools. It actively scans log entries as syslog gets them and then tells the admins what's happening. So when Tux's Angels arrived on site, the sysadmins gave us a bit of information about their IDS solution, and this is how it looked. There we go. So this is what was installed. Snort started at boot and was obviously the network intrusion detection system and started to monitor all network traffic. And it was configured to log to a MySQL database as well as to log to syslog. Base was also installed, enabling the admins to look at alerts and search through alert histories to find, for example, previous incidents of an alert. Dumpcap also started at boot and had a rolling capture buffer. So every 60 seconds, it would create a new file of all the network traffic collected. Swatch also started at boot and was configured to watch the syslog output and using a regex kick off a custom script whenever a snort alert was found. This custom script then grabbed the PCAPs generated by Dumpcap for 1 minute before the alert through to 3 minutes after an alert had occurred. These PCAPs were then merged using MergeCAP into one big PCAP, and then TCP flow was then run over this PCAP extracting the flows. So in the end, the sysadmins at Playground Inc. had access to the saved snort alert, the TCP flows and the PCAP of the whole event, and as well as they could look in base and find previous occurrences of the alerts or domains, IPs, whatever. So now we're going to do a brief demo. Ooh. Okay. Oh. Excellent. Okay, as you can see up there, I think. Oh, thank you. Yep, we've got Swatch is running as well as Dumpcap running. Oh, there we go. And Dumpcap, as you can see, is creating files that are 60 seconds long. When it reaches 400 files, it's going to start overriding the buffer. So that's what's capturing all the network traffic. We also have Snort running down the bottom. Snort is logging to a MySQL database as well as to syslog, as was mentioned, and that's their network intrusion detection system. So this is what the sysadmins at Playground Inc. showed us when we went on site. And this is how they were viewing the snort alerts. They were using base, which I mentioned before. So this is initially what kicked off the fact that something strange was happening, because you can see three unique alerts there. So they knew something strange was happening on their system. All TCP based, and they showed us that there was info telnet login incorrect and bad login alerts which had been generated. So they knew something strange was happening on their system. And you can see that all these alerts had started were on the 19th of December at about 3:49. And this is the results of the custom script they showed us. So as you can see here, some folders have been generated by timestamp. And this is all the output of the process that was mentioned. So there's a meta file which is going to contain all the snort alerts. So again, then we can see that there's a telnet alert which has been kicked off, so something strange is happening. And also, after running TCP flow over the top of that massive PCAP, we can see that there's also some strange action happening here. Someone's attempting to log in at root out to another, from alpha out to another box on the internet. I think I got that right. Ah, thank you. Okay, so now the results of looking at what the sysadmins had on their IDS. Can we see that there was a suspected compromise? Well, yes, there's something obviously strange happening because there were some snort alerts detailing that there were some unsuccessful telnet logins showing someone trying to log in as root from alpha. And also, after the sysadmins looked at the snort alerts, they then looked at the AFIC database and found that there were three new unexplained executable files. There was ints.exe, ints2.exe, and msindexer.exe. The packet captures and log files were passed to Tux's Angels to begin collecting evidence of the compromise. So we then added all the information onto the timeline, and as you can see, there's a little period there where we show where the three new executable files were created. And also you can see the Telnet login has now been added to the timeline. So we're really just building up what's happening with the investigation now. So that completes the detection phase of our incident response lifecycle. I'm going to pass over to Vanessa, who is our collection expert.
Just here. Well, thank you, Amelia. So what does the collection phase during the incident response cycle actually involve? Basically, the collection phase involves collecting as much data as possible to assist you in actually investigating a particular incident. This involves either using, either hardware or software forensic tools to collect the data. And then once it has been collected, actually verifying its integrity to ensure that data has been properly acquired and that there were no errors. So data in investigation can come from multiple sources. This includes desktop computers, servers, networks, and even things like talking to people who were involved in that particular incident, network logs and diagrams, and even physical access logs to a server room can all be of use when you're investigating an incident. Now, there are a variety of open source tools available to forensically collect data for investigative purposes. These include tools used to capture network and memory and disk associated data. So first up, network collection. And obviously collecting data from a network is quite useful as it can give you leads as to what nasties are sitting on your network. Tools useful for capturing network traffic include Wireshark, which I'm sure you all know and love. Also TCP dump and Dumpcap, which both use the PCAP library to capture traffic from your network on the command line. Since we actually don't require an analysis tool when we're on site doing incident response, and I guess don't need something like Wireshark, our tool of choice is TCP dump, as it is used on the command line. We're able to attain and generate the required and necessary data, and it's normally pre-installed too. Memory collection. I guess collecting the contents of a machine's physical memory can be quite useful, especially for determining things like the running processes and even network connections that are sitting on the machine. Techniques useful for capturing the system's memory include the crash dump technique by using a hotkey. However, to use this technique, the registry settings on the machine need to be pre-configured. So obviously this is not a viable solution in most cases. Another technique which can be used is the Windows hibernation method. And basically that compresses contents of RAM onto system volume. However, this option is only useful for hardware-compatible laptops. Now, I guess since we need a tool that can be used across multiple hardware types, our tool of choice is the Forensic Acquisition Utilities DD, which is basically a modified version of DD that has the ability to image physical memory. But we will come back to that later. Disk collection. Disk collection is basically the process of acquiring either a logical or a bit-for-bit image of a machine's hard disk. Ideally, when you are acquiring data or disk data for an investigation, where it is possible, a bitstream image of the hard disk should be acquired, as this does capture all sectors, available accessible sectors on a hard disk, so your file system, your slack space, and even deleted files. Now, what are the tools that are useful for collecting disk data? No doubt you're all familiar with DD, but if you're not, DD is used to copy and convert raw data. So its ability to take a source input and generate a bitstream image means it is widely used in computer forensics. Another tool that we have considered in the past is SDD, which is a modified and faster version of DD, which also displays time statistics. However, our tool of choice is DCFL DD, which is also a modified version of DD, but in addition to displaying time statistics, also performs on-the-fly verification, which is often quite useful. So when Tux's Angels arrived on site, Alpha was indeed compromised and unfortunately looked like this. Yes, it was infested. Pretty bad. Based on the fact that Alpha was clearly compromised and still switched on, the first thing we did when we got on site was actually take a memory dump of the machine using FAUDD and basically use Netcat to transport the image across to our IR laptop. And I probably should mention now, actually, when we do go on site, we'll take our incident response laptop with us, and that usually has all our tools. Next, we rebooted Alpha into a Helix Live CD environment and captured a bitstream image of the hard disk using DCFLDD. And after that, basically we isolated Alpha away from the network and rebooted the workstation into its compromised OS and basically took a network capture using TCP dump. And the reason we did this was so we could later analyse any startup connections that were being established on boot. And probably should mention too, also took a copy of the gateway PCAPs that were generated from the rolling dump cap buffer, which Amelia talked about before. And so just going to show you a demo now, and this is us basically capturing the dump of Alpha's memory. So as you can see here, we're on the IR laptop, and we're using Netcat and establishing a listening port so we can actually pipe data received through DCFLDD. And you'll notice we're using a hash handle, and that's to perform an MD5 sum on the output of Alpha physical mem.dd. So now we're on Alpha, which is the compromise box, and we're using FAUDD and netcatting input of the physical memory through to the IR machine on port 5000. And you will notice too, we're going to perform an MD5 sum also for verification purposes, which is quite important when you are collecting data. And that's copying now. So back on the IR laptop, you can see DCFLDD chugging away and outputting the copying statistics to screen and obviously generating the MD5 hash as we speak. That was weird. This isn't planned. And I've lost my train of thought. What's really cool, now we've just verified the hashes to make sure that the copying didn't error, and that looks right, meaning there were no errors. And where am I? Cool. Thanks, Kay. Very good. So as you can see, using both DCFLDD and FAUDD are very simple. And both can be used to write to connected external devices and also even over a socket, so using Netcat. Okay, so just to wrap up the collection phase, looking at our timeline, we've added the sequence of collection stages to our timeline, and that just makes sure that we're recording everything on all events in order and understand what's happening. So now I'll pass you over to Kate, who will talk you through the analysis phase.
All right, thanks, Amelia. All right, we're on to the last phase, the analysis phase. We've got a lot to fly through, so strap in. hopefully this will be the most interesting part of the talk because we'll find out what happened. So obviously the analysis phase is the last phase of the incident response lifecycle. And it's when we look at the data or analyse the data that we acquired during the collection phase in order to basically solve the case. So this phase is arguably the most complex and time-consuming of all the phases in the investigative process. The purpose of the analysis phase is confirmatory analysis and event reconstruction. According to Brian Carrier, who's an expert in the computer forensics field, the recommended methodology for this phase is the C data analytic approach, which involves surveying, extracting and examining the data. So for this investigation, we have three priorities. We want to determine the cause of the compromise, the extent of the compromise, or what happened on Alpha after it was compromised, and the functionality and the identity of the malware. So the data we have at our disposal is the PCAPs from the gateway and the ones that were taken at startup, the disk image of Alpha, and Alpha's physical memory. So let's now have a look at the analysis tools we'll use on each of these data sets. So the first data set we analysed was the network PCAPs. The tools we considered were TCP extract. So this is a tool for extracting files from network traffic based on file signatures. So it's basically file carving for network traffic. Ngrep, which is basically grep for the network layer. So we're able to create regexes to match data payloads. And Netdude, which is a framework for inspection, analysis, and manipulation of TCP dump files. It's very similar to Wireshark. But our tool of choice was, in fact, Wireshark, mainly because it was the network analysis tool we were most familiar with and most efficient at using. It also included many of the features of the other tools. We all know what Wireshark looks like, but just to refresh your memory. So let's take a moment to remind ourselves about what the customer's network looked like. So we've got Alpha, the domain controller, and the gateway. So to start, we surveyed the data. The network capture we received whilst on site was from approximately 1:30 p.m. through to 8 p.m. on the 19th of December. It's also worth noting that the capture was taken on the external interface of the gateway, so 192.168.1.1, and this is important to know because most of the connections in the capture will have a source IP address that's not Alpha. Our first observation after analysing the data was that at approximately 2 p.m, Alpha started using a proxy rather than a direct connection to the internet. And the IP address of this proxy was 192.168.1.2. And even though that's a private address, in this case, it's an untrusted IP address. So analysis of the traffic prior to Alpha communicating with this proxy, 192.168.1.1, revealed the following. If the top band represents seconds, middle band represents minutes, and the bottom band represents hour. At approximately 1:30 p.m, Alpha makes a DNS request to wpad.myturf.net, which returns the IP address 192.168.1.2. Alpha then requests the configuration file, wpad.dat, from 192.168.1.2. So using Wireshark, we were actually able to inspect the configuration file, wpad.dat, that was returned from 192.168.1.2, and it looks like this. So as you can see, the function states that if the destination host is not within the playground domain, use proxy.myturf.net, which is 192.168.1.2. So let's just take a moment to refresh our memory on what WPAD is. So it's the Web Proxy Auto Discovery Protocol, and it's used when web browsers have been set to automatically detect their proxy settings. So the proxy configuration file, wpad.dat, can be published via DHCP and DNS, with DHCP given the higher priority. So in this case, DHCP was not actually implemented on the playground domain, so DNS was used. When a DNS lookup is done, the first part of the client's fully qualified domain name is replaced with WPAD. If this request fails, it then moves up the domain hierarchy until it gets a hit. So for this incident, here's what's happened. Alpha makes a DNS request for the WPAD server in its current domain, which fails. Alpha then tries WPAD in the parent domain, which is passed upstream, and also fails. Alpha then makes a DNS request for the WPAD server in its next parent domain, so myturf.net, which again is passed upstream but returns the IP address 192.168.1.2. So we're left asking ourselves, does this change in proxy have anything to do with Alpha getting compromised? Well, further analysis of the network capture revealed that 32 minutes after the WPAD DNS request was made, the administrator started downloading the Firefox, the latest Firefox setup. And this activity doesn't actually seem suspicious, as it correlates with our knowledge that the administrator was downloading and installing applications on Alpha at the time of compromise. But Alpha is now using an untrusted proxy. So I suppose the real question is, was the executable what the administrator was expecting? Well, using Wireshark, we were able to inspect the ASCII output of the downloaded executable. So here we can see that the Firefox setup was downloaded using proxy.myturf.net. Further inspection revealed a series of strings in the executable, such as file 1 start, file 1 end, file copied, process created, and this is my bad food, bad food. Other strings such as bad stuff, 192.168.1.3, so a new IP address, and the string this is my bad food was also present further down in the executable. So, was the executable the administrator downloaded the real Firefox? No way. Further analysis revealed that anything downloaded via the proxy 192.168.1.2 with a content type of application octet stream was prepended with two executables, like this. So two executables at the top and a legitimate executable the user requested at the bottom. So in this case, the Firefox setup. So based on this evidence, we can now conclude that 192.168.1.2 is a bad proxy, presumably running Squid and Apache that has been configured in a malicious manner. And the proxy works as depicted here. So further analysis of the traffic using Wireshark also revealed that 47 seconds after the Firefox setup was downloaded, a TCP connection, which appears to be encrypted, was made between Alpha and a new IP address, 192.168.1.3. So with all of this information in mind, we're starting to build up a picture about what the attacker's network looks like. And we've identified two machines, 192.168.1.2, which is our malicious proxy, and 192.168.1.3, which is suspected at this stage of being the malware controller. And the third machine you can see there on your right is just the upstream external DNS server. So if we go back to our analysis priorities, at this stage, we have sufficient evidence to support the claim that the cause of compromise was due to a change in proxy, which resulted in a malicious version of Firefox being downloaded and executed on Alpha. Let's now move on to the disk analysis portion of the investigation. So there's many different disk analysis tools that were considered for this phase of the investigation. Multi-purpose tools such as SleuthKit and Autopsy, and various single-purpose utilities such as TestDisk, PhotoRec, RegLookup, RegTime, GrokEVT, Pasco, and Zline were all considered. Our tool selection was ultimately determined by the analysis tasks we wished to complete, which included doing an antivirus scan, an analysis of MAC times, browser history, event logs, the registry, and also performing file carving. So the tools which best suited our needs were a combination of a multi-purpose tool, and in this case we chose PyFlag, and various single-purpose utilities, which included ClamAV for the antivirus scan, a Perl script called Mork for the Mozilla history, SleuthKit utilities called FLS, MacTime, and DLS, Scalpel for file carving, and of course MD5 sum files, file and strings. These tools enabled us to achieve the disk analysis tasks in the most efficient manner possible. All right, so the first analysis task we did was an AV scan using ClamAV. The features we liked most about ClamAV was that it could be scheduled to be updated and to run using cron. The log output of ClamAV could be easily grepped to get results, so found viruses. And these results could then be scripted so that we could extract the infected files from the disk image in a really efficient manner. Unfortunately, obviously, the big issue with antivirus is that it can be a bit hit and miss. And this is primarily due to the lag time between new variants being discovered in the wild and signatures being issued for those variants. Our investigation actually detected 36 instances of the generic virus Trojan Small, So this confirmed the presence of malware. And a lot of those files were actually temporary or copies of the original malware. Further research using VirusTotal indicated that the virus could be a variant of backdoor.poison. But this didn't give us enough information to finalise our investigation. We then used MD5SUM to help us identify the unique viruses. And the results indicated that the unique viruses were in fact inst.exe and inst2, which was also MSIndexer, which was also live.exe. They were all the same executable. It's worth pointing out that the AFIC hash database also identified these same files as new files on the system, as Amelia spoke about earlier in the detection phase. The strings of these executables actually matched the executables in the Firefox setup, so we're able to correlate network evidence with the evidence in the network traffic, so disk evidence with network evidence. So those two executables we had there, prepended to the real Firefox setup, are now inst.exe and inst2.exe or msindexer or live.exe. Hopefully that makes sense. All right, so the So the forensic suite PyFlag was then used next to perform map time analysis on files as well as the registry, and also event log analysis and IE cache analysis. And we just so happened to have two PyFlag developers in the audience today, Michael Cohen and David Collette. Unfortunately, we don't have time today to actually demonstrate the full capacity of PyFlag. So if you'd like to see it in action, I'd encourage you all to go along to the tutorial at 10:30 on Thursday. You can pay me later, Michael. So this is the map time analysis interface in PyFlag. As we can see here, we've actually implemented a filter to show us any modified files on the 19th of December, which was the date of the incident. So PyFlag basically enabled us to confirm that the initial compromise was in fact the Firefox setup. And it also gave us an insight into how the malware unpacks. So let's just have a quick look at that now. So when the setup was actually written to disk, the first thing that was done was the administrator executed the setup without checking the MD5 of the binary against the MD5 published on Mozilla's website. No one does that. The first bit of code that was run was inst.exe or the unpacker. And this stripped out inst2.exe or the malware, and it dropped that to disk and ran it. It then stripped out the legitimate Firefox setup, wrote it to disk, and deleted the malicious Firefox setup, which was initially downloaded. So the MD5 sum of the setup on disk actually matches the MD5 sum of a trusted copy, because the other malicious one was actually deleted. So what does the string, "this is my bad food" mean? Well, it's actually the unique separator the hacker used to mark the start and the end of each of the executables. So using PyFlag, we were also able to determine the techniques the malware used for persistence. And it did this by copying itself to the startup folder as msindexer, and also to the Windows live directory as live.exe. It also created a series of registry keys in the ntuser.dat hive and a service in the system hive, as we can see here. So if we go back to our priorities, by analysing Alpha's disk image, we were able to determine that the original malware was inst2.exe, sorry, and the method of persistence that the malware used was by creating registry keys and copying itself to the startup directory. Although we haven't demonstrated it explicitly here, the map time analysis of the disk image also gave us an insight into the functionality of the malware. And its ability to do keylogging and copying password hashes. Last one, memory. So for the memory analysis, the tools we considered were PTFinder, which can be used to find processes and threads in memory, and pool tools, which can be used to examine memory pool allocations. The Windows incident response and computer forensics tools were also considered, but our tool of choice was Volatility. Because it just works, it's intuitive, it's written in Python, so it's cross-platform, and it suited our needs because it supports extracting digital artifacts from volatile memory images from a Windows XP SP2 system. It's also just recently been incorporated into PyFlag. All right, so to just finish up, we'll just have a quick demo of volatility rather than talking about it. So as we can see here, volatility runs with many different commands. The first one we'll look at is the identification of the physical memory taken with alpha. So that's ident. As we can see here, volatility can determine the image type, in this case XPSP2, the VM type being PAE, and the date and time that the actual memory was acquired. We'll also now look at all the processes that were running while the memory was actually acquired. So process listing. It's interesting to see that Helix, DD and Netcat were actually running, and this is what we were running at the time of collection. And also Firefox is running with a PID of 1812. So we know Firefox is somehow linked with this investigation, so that's probably of significance. We'll now look at all the open connections that were running when we actually acquired the memory. And if we look at the very bottom one, we can see that Alpha has actually made a connection to 192.168.1.3 on port 3460. And the process ID is 1812, which matches the process ID of Firefox.exe. So we've been able to put those two bits of information together. We can also look at all the open files associated with a certain process. So for the Firefox process, they're all the files that it was using and they were open. We can also look at the DLLs that process was using. So we'll just search for 1812. We can see the parameters that it was actually run with, and I'm not sure that they are standard. And we can also see all the DLLs that it was using. So this may be useful to us if we want to go into malware reverse engineering or take this investigation a step further. We can also look at all the open modules that were being used on the system at the time of the acquisition. Volatility can also be used to dump out a process. So in this case, if we wanted to extract the process, Firefox.exe, we could use that dump. But that's beyond the scope of today's presentation. All right, we're nearly done. So from the demo, we saw that in the process listing, there was obviously that Firefox process running with a PID of 1812. It's interesting to note that when we went on site to collect the memory, Firefox was not actually running, so obviously that's suspicious. We also determined that Firefox was the process responsible for the connection to 192.168.1.3 on port 3460, and that it was running with what appeared to be non-standard parameters. So we used our trusty friend Google and put those two bits of information into a query, and we returned a result, Poison Ivy. Which is a well-known piece of malware. It's interesting to know that Poison Ivy actually injects itself into the default browser, in this case, Firefox. So we've solved the case. Our last priority was the identity of the malware, and we've done that. All right, so we've completed the analysis phase, and with all good life cycles, they always go back to where they've begun. So at this point, we would feed the results of this analysis phase back into detection, and this would obviously aid in future detection and to prevent future compromise. All right, I'll now hand over to Vanessa, who'll quickly run through the conclusion.
Everyone hear me? Okay. So I promise I won't keep you here too much longer. Just quickly to recap the sequence of timeline events, right at the top we have very first compromise and all associated events, and if you work your way down to the bottom where Tux's angels actually responded to the incident. Okay, so what now? Based on the findings from our analysis, we developed a list of recommendations for Playground Incorporated to actually implement. Also keep in mind that these are mitigation strategies that can be applied in many scenarios, not just this case study. So firstly, blocking outbound comms. In this case, comms to 192.168.1.2 and .3 should both be blocked. Trying to prevent further compromise, so in this case we would recommend that the customer rectify the WPAD configuration. Re-imaging the infected machine, so in this case we would recommend that Alpha's re-imaged before actually bringing it back online. Ensuring no mechanism for persistence, so making sure that checking for MAC drives, network shares and also roaming profiles. And finally, assessing the damage, so determining the extent of damage, for example, loss of data, financial loss, etc. Tool wrapper. So just to recap some of the tools that we did talk about today, through the detection phase, we looked at Swatch, Snort, Dumpcap and Base, which all can be used for proactive detection. The collection phase, we looked at DCF-LDD, FAUDD and TCP dump, which all can be used to capture useful data for investigating an incident. And finally, the most important phase, analysis tools like Wireshark, PyFlag and Volatility can all help you find out what happened during compromise. So how can you use these tools even if you're not in an IR team like ourselves? If you're a proactive system administrator, these tools could be quite useful for you. If you're imaging across a corporate network, troubleshooting, file recovery or performing backups, or if you're game to perform forensic investigations in your corporate environment. So on behalf of myself, Kate and Amelia, we would like to thank you, and we really do hope that our presentation has showed you a few tools and techniques that you can go away and utilise. And on that note too, I'll probably take this opportunity, if you do like this kind of work and you think it's pretty cool, do come and talk to us after, because the team, our team, the Computer Network Vulnerability Team, will be recruiting in a few weeks, so we'd like to talk to you. Also, just quickly, we would like to thank our hacker, Eddie, who actually crafted up this hack for us and for this investigation, so it was quite cool. Thank you, Eddie. Your help is quite appreciated. And thanks to LCA for giving us the opportunity to talk today. Oops.